Please pray with me. Almighty God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Having a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old, I've seen my fair share of Disney movies. My favorite Disney movie, I think, though, is the movie Up. Have you seen the movie Up? So if you've seen that, you know, I think it's one of the most unusual, for sure, kid movies, but maybe also Disney movie in general, in the way that it starts. It's got a 6-minute thing at the beginning that tells the story, the love story, the life story, really, of the this girl named Ellie and someone whom we later know to be Mr. Fredrickson, okay? And so what happens is Ellie is probably like 8, 9, 10, kind of around there. She is really enamored about this guy named, who's this great explorer named Muntz. And so she has this helmet and she has these goggles and she pretends to be Mr. Muntz, the great explorer, you know. Well, guess what? Little Mr. Fredrickson, he does the same thing. And they don't know each other. And so the movie begins by Ellie in this kind of abandoned house playing the explorer and little Mr. Fredrickson hopping down the street, goggles, helmet, the whole thing. And he is playing the explorer, and then he hears someone else inside this house playing the explorer. So he goes in, and there's Ellie, and he's behind her. She doesn't know he's there. And she's saying, "Enter the weather in the logbook. Visibility, unlimited." You know, and then she turns and she sees him, and she's got the same goggles and the same hat, and she says, "Just because you're wearing a goggles and hat doesn't mean you're an explorer. Do you think you have what it takes to be an explorer? Well, do ya? And you can tell immediately, Ellie is this very extroverted, very aggressive, little Mr. Fredrickson, the total opposite. He's starting to shrink inside himself as she's railing on him. And in fact, for the first 6 minutes of the movie, Fredrickson never speaks. It's all Ellie. And Ellie can tell she's freaking him out. And so she takes off her helmet and her hair, poof, and she goes, "It's all right. If you can swear, if you swear that you'll uphold the values of our one-person explorer society, then you can be a member. Do you swear?" And he nods his head, you know. And she hands him this little metal bottle cap with a safety pin and hooks it to his shirt, and she says, "Welcome." And then they play, he gets hurt. He ends up at his house that night with a cast on his arm, and Ellie comes by to, you know, cheer him up. And so she sends this balloon that floats up through the window. That's important if you've seen Up. You know, this balloon comes through the window, and she comes in, and she's going to tell him this great story that pertains to this book that she has, her adventure book, and that's what it's called, My Adventure Book. And she's going to tell him her great story for her life. And she says, "What I want to do is when I get big, I want to be an explorer just like Mr. Muntz. And I'm going to go down to South America. It's like America, but South." And then she says, "Look at this picture. This is where I'm going to live." And she shows him this picture of this setting on the bluffs. And she says, "I ripped it right out of a library book." And he goes, "Oh," you know, he's totally offended. And then she says, "The only question, though, is how am I going to get there? How will I get there?" And little Mr. Fredrickson looks up at his balloon. And she says, "Genius! Swear you'll take us there. Swear it. Cross your heart." And he goes, you know, he's backing up the whole time, and he crosses his heart. And she says, "There, you promised. No backing out." And the rest of the movie is little Mr. Fredrickson, who grows up in about minute number 6, and Ellie dies in minute number 6. And the rest of the movie is about Mr. Fredrickson carrying out that oath, carrying out that promise. And in fact, Ellie kind of lives on in the rest of the movie in this picture of her, which sits on his mantle. And it's a really important part in the rest of the movie. Her presence is almost there. And in fact, sometimes he'll talk to the picture as if she's there. Those two dynamics, the swear it, cross your heart, that dynamic together with the picture of Ellie on the mantle is actually what is behind those concepts are behind our gospel passage today. So as we continue in our study together of the Sermon on the Mount, we're now into the third of 6 of these units. where Jesus says, "You've heard that it was said, but I say to you." And you recall that what we said about that, Jesus is not correcting or amending the Old Testament. He's correcting the interpretation of the Old Testament, the scribes and the Pharisees at the time. And the first couple, we spent some time, we saw that they were kind of quotes, actually, from sections of the Old Testament. And now as we get out here, we'll see this one that we have now in Matthew chapter 5, verse 34. It's not a quote at all. Let me read the text, and then we'll get into it. Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 33 to verse 37. Hear the word of the Lord. "Again, you have heard it said to those of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn.' But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say simply be yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil." May God add his blessing to the reading, the hearing, and now the study of his holy word. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the Pharisees or the scribes' false teaching, Jesus' true teaching, and then how to live in light of it. All right? That's how we're going to break the passage. The false teaching, the true teaching, and then how to live in light of it. The false teaching there, as we saw in Jesus mentions it in verses 33 and 34. To understand what's behind this, we have to understand the difference between a vow and an oath. The difference between a vow and an oath. In fact, this is the reason why I started actually with the story about the Disney movie. Because, you know, even as I read that a second ago, I'm just reminded again that so many times as we're reading the scriptures, it can seem to us, especially as we get out here in the Sermon on the Mount, it can seem to us like fortune cookie statements. And you can read that kind of a statement and you think, you know, where Jesus says, "Don't swear by heaven, don't swear by earth, don't swear by Jerusalem." And you might think, who would even do that? Right? And you might think, well, we're going to move on to something more applicable because I don't know anybody who does that kind of thing. And the reason why we can have that reaction is because in our culture, there are really only two places left where you can expect to swear to something. In the first century, it was very, very common. They had those two places, which we'll talk about in a second, but it was also common even outside there. The two places today where you can expect to be, I have to swear to something. What do you think they are? The first place? Court. Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help me God. And what do you do whenever you swear, especially if you're going to become in a public office? A lot of times, depending on the office it is, you'll put your right hand in the air and your left hand on the... We'll come back to that one. So that's the first place you can be expected to swear something. What's the other place? No? Marriage ceremony. You were in the second service today. Marriage ceremony. There are two types of swearing. And I'm not talking about cussing. There are two types of swearing. One is a vow, and the other is an oath. And it's important to understand the difference so that we can understand what the Pharisees were teaching here. A vow, listen, a vow is a promise to God with other people as a witness. That's what happens in a marriage ceremony. You make a vow. You're promising to God something, and there are other people who are a witness. An oath is a promise to someone else with God as your witness. Do you see the difference? In a vow, I'm making a promise to God with other people as the witness. And an oath, it's reverse, right? So in both of those, you swear it. You swear the oath. But there's even a kind of a third kind of colloquial thing, which is actually what we're dealing with here. And it lives on a little bit in our culture, less so than it did in the first century. And that is where someone, I swear that happened. Or the little kid's version, cross your heart. Cross it. It's a formula. The idea is there's some kind of a formula that's going to heighten your sense of the obligation to tell the truth. Or it's going to heighten, it's going to ratchet it up, that you're really going to mean what you say when it comes on the other side of the thing that you're swearing. And so that's the critical background to understand the two ways to swear something. You just make a promise to God in the sight of other people. What's that called? A vow. You make a promise to other people in the sight of God. What's that called? Now, we're going to see them mingled in a second. And this is the key thing as we're trying to understand what is the false teaching here that Jesus is speaking about that the Pharisees and the scribes were giving. Look in verse 33. Jesus says, "Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn.'" Well, that sounds like a vow. I shall perform to the Lord whatever it is that I swore. But look in the very next verse. "But I say to you, do not take an oath." Do not take an oath at all. Well, we just said that an oath is a promise to somebody else in the sight of God. So what's the deal there? What is the deal? Here was the teaching at the time. This is the teaching at the time. There's actually a commentary on this later in Matthew chapter 23 we'll look at in a second. Here was the teaching. The scribes, the rabbis, the religious authorities of the day were teaching you this. If you make a promise to God, if you make a vow, you must keep that. A failure to keep that is sin. You got to keep that. If you make a promise to somebody else and you invoke God as a witness to that promise, you have to keep that too. Because by invoking God as the witness to that, essentially, you are also kind of making a promise to him. Even though it's an oath to somebody else, you're calling on God to be a witness, so you've got to keep it. Now, here's the catch. If you're a first century Jew, you never use the word God. It's too holy. You don't refer to God by name. A little Bible study moment. When you're reading in your Bible and you see the word Lord, L-O-R-D, in small caps, that is referring, it's translating the divine name, which is Yahweh. Too holy, can't use that if you're a first century Jew. So what do you do if you're a first century Jew and you want to make a promise to God or call God to be a witness to whatever the oath is? The answer is you refer to an object that signifies or refers to him. You know, a modern example of that would be someone who raises their right hand and puts their left hand on the Bible. Why would you do that? It signifies and brings present God himself. That's the idea there. Well, guess what? The people were doing the very same thing. And in fact, in Matthew chapter 23, there's an extended commentary on this very thing. And you know, we spent several weeks on the Beatitudes, and each of the Beatitudes begins with the word blessed. Blessed are. And we saw that there's two different kinds of blesseds in the New Testament. The Greek word makarios, which means fortunate, flourishing. And then the Greek word eulogetes, which means to speak well of. The opposite of a blessing is a curse. Really, the opposite of eulogetes is a curse. To speak well of, to speak bad against. That's malediction. The opposite of makarios, the opposite of that, what we see in the Beatitudes, the opposite of that is a woe. You know the woe statements? Woe to you if. Woe to, you know, Isaiah talks about himself that way in Isaiah 7. Woe am I, for I'm a man of unclean lips, and I am undone. Matthew chapter 23, starting in verse 16. Woe to you, says Jesus. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, what do they say? If anyone swears by the temple, it is nothing. You don't have to keep that oath. But if anyone swears by the gold in the temple, he is bound by that oath. Jesus continues, blind fools, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that has made the gold sacred? And you say, if anyone swears by the altar, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift that is on the altar, he is bound by his oath. You blind men, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? So whoever swears by the altar swears by it and everything on it. And whoever swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it. The people were being taught that if they made a promise, they couldn't use the word God. So they would reference something as a stand-in. So the stand-in might be, for example, the temple, which is where God's presence was supposed to dwell. And so if you reference the temple, you're getting closer to God. But you see what I'm saying? So then the sort of case law developed. Well, how close is close? When do I cross that line where I'm really going to have to keep it? Or can I just say, well, see, the thing is, I swore by the temple instead of the, and that's the reason why I wasn't telling the truth. Come on. If I had sworn by the gold in the temple, then of course I would have been telling the truth. You see, I swore by the altar and not the gift on the altar. If I had sworn by the gift on the altar, then of course I would have followed through with what I meant, right? So that's the teaching. And the Pharisees and the scribes were teaching people that that level, the kind of levels of truthfulness that's reflected there, was a form of holiness and that it was pleasing to the Lord. The kind of hair-splitting duplicity. That's the teaching. That's the first point. What was the false teaching in the scribes and the Pharisees? Here's the summary of it. If a person made a promise to God, they had to keep it. If a person made a promise to someone else with God as a witness, and they made a reference that fell with pretty close, they had to keep that one. But if they made a promise to someone else, or they swore an oath that was supposed to bolster their veracity, you know, their credibility, it's going to bolster their credibility, and they swore by something that was kind of farther from God or farther, well, you didn't have to keep that one. It wasn't as bad. And so that's the teaching. How does Jesus respond to that? Well, he responds to that in verses 34 through 37. And he kind of gives a kind of a, sort of a negative response and a positive response, and kind of a negative teaching and a positive teaching. The negative is in verse 34. Look at it there with me. Jesus says, "Do not swear an oath at all." Well, let's pause there for just a second. Do not swear an oath at all. Let's pause there. If you look back with me for just a second in your bulletin on page 4, in the Hebrews passage. For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he, that is God, had no one greater by whom to swear, he, that is God, swore by himself, saying, "Surely I will bless you and multiply you." And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in one of their disputes, an oath is final for confirmation. So, when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it by an oath. So what gives? Why does Jesus say in verse 34 here of chapter 5, don't swear an oath at all? And yet here we see the writer of the Hebrews saying, you know, God swore an oath. And it's also in our psalm. There's an oath that's referred to about the Davidic covenant, the covenant that God makes with David. So God swears oaths. What's the deal? Here's the deal. The text makes it really clear, actually, the Hebrews text. For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes, an oath is final. Verse 17 of chapter 6 of Hebrews. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise, when God desired to show more convincingly to we, the stiff-necked people and stubborn people, people who are easy, we easily forget God's providences and kindness and his mercy and his grace, when he desired to show to us his truthfulness, that he's going to follow through. He made an oath. When you put these things together, the teaching is this. If somebody wants you to take an oath because it's going to make them feel better about your veracity or your willing, your credibility or your willingness to carry through, fine. But as for you, as a disciple, you need to know that you're always under oath. You're always under oath. And further, that there ought to be no levels of truthfulness among the disciples. There ought to be no levels of truthfulness among the disciples. Why? Well, that's the positive teaching that Jesus gives as he gets further out into these verses here. Verse 34, don't swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, because it's its footstool, or by Jerusalem, because it's the city of the great king, capital K. So you might think, you know, I'm never going to run into that kind of trouble, because I don't even talk like that, right? What's he saying there? Remember the teaching from the scribes and the Pharisees, that you can get away from God. You can get far enough away from God in your reference. You know, you can't use the word God, but you can refer to things that relate to God. You can get far enough away from that it's okay for you to not, that'll be in a low level of truthfulness. It's okay for you not to keep that. What Jesus is saying here is, look, if you're going to swear by heaven, God's there. If you're going to swear by earth, his feet are there. If you're going to swear by the great city of Jerusalem, that's his city. You cannot get away from God. He owns everything. You know, the Children's Catechism says, does God know all things? And the answer that the kids give back is yes. Nothing can be hidden from God. And so what Jesus is saying there, kind of the positive part of his teaching there, is for the disciples, for people who are trying to be serious students of the Sermon on the Mount, and people who are deliberately and intentionally trying to live out the life under Jesus' rule and reign, there ought to be no levels of truthfulness. There's no way in which you can say, well, God doesn't see this, but he sees that. You can't turn his picture over. He's there. He sees. He knows. The thing that you swear the oath for, I swear on my mother's grave. I just want you to see how common this kind of thing is. I swear on a stack of... Their attempts to bolster your credibility to the person you're speaking to. That there's a kind of a puffery that's going on there that Jesus is trying to say ought not be the case among disciples. Let your yes be your yes, verse 37. Simply let what you say be yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil, as the ESV translates it. It has a footnote, though, which is more likely. Anything more than this comes from the evil one. Deceit and duplicity. So, let's look at a couple of examples about what this might look like today. You know, the idea here is that nobody taking an oath, that kind of thing, I swear in a second, you know, or you're trying to puff yourself up. The idea is that you're committing yourself to a higher standard of honesty than you normally would. They're trying to make it really clear. Nobody demands an oath from someone whose word is that person's bond. You know, the child that says to the parent, Dad, can we go play catch? And the dad responds, later. And the child who's heard that before has kind of gotten wise to that. And the child responds by saying, you promise? You promise? Because the child has come to learn that later really means no. Or maybe. And so the child wants to put the parent under oath, essentially, right? So there's a kind of a cultural barrier that we're trying to surmount and get around and go through here in this passage. Let me give you a couple of examples by way of application, or a couple of questions by way of application. Do you ever say one thing when you mean another? That story about the playing catch was me, by the way. Do you ever say one thing and do another? Are you one way in public and another way in private? Are you one way online and a different way in person? Let me give you a couple of just basic kinds of regular interactions that we participate in, or that happen to us, that fall within this passage that Jesus is saying. One, I want to look at social lies. Social lies says, I'd love to go, but I'm going to be out of town. When you're not, of course. Right? Another one would say, I didn't get the email until the event was over. You know, you didn't want to go to the event, and you got the email. You said, oh, I just saw the text. I'm sorry. You know, when, of course, you saw it before, and some of you are laughing. You're like, oh, no, that one. Social lies. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Word inflation. It was so wonderful. It was so great. The Lord was so present. And that's great when those things are true. But if every time someone asks you about an event, you say, it was wonderful, it was great, the Lord was so present, they're going to kind of go, of course, yeah, I knew you were going to say that, you know. And they become a little distrustful. I mean, like, is it really every event, everything is like that, you know, for you? They get a little cynical. Another example is a benevolent lie. A benevolent lie, it says something like this, how do I look? Or somebody presents, that was a weird response, by the way, from you guys here. How do I look? Not me. Don't say that. Or somebody presents some kind of a project. You know, they've been working on it for a long time. And they say, what do you think? And, you know, and what you say is, it's pretty good. When what you really need to say is, stop doing that. You know, like, and somebody needs to tell the person that. But instead of people telling the person, not in a club you on the head kind of a way, you know, telling the truth in the way that Jesus tells the truth, not in the way that I'm valiant for truth. You come to me, I'll tell you the truth. You know, I'm not talking about that. But somebody needs to tell the person, you know, you're not really gifted in that. But instead, people sort of quietly and gently encourage. And we're just setting that person up for trouble. We're not letting our yes be yes, our no be no. The last one's routine business lies. Don't say publicly, we're for quality, when privately we're cutting corners. Don't say publicly, we're for training and resourcing and building up our staff or our employees, when privately you're abusing them. Don't say publicly, the numbers look great, when privately you place a bunch of orders at the end of the quarter to bump up the quarterly numbers, knowing that you're just going to cancel those orders. Routine business lines. This is more in the ballpark, right? You said earlier, those of you, well, I don't swear by heaven or earth or Jerusalem or the great, I don't do that. But, you know, some of these things we say, oh, yeah, guilty. What would it be like? What would it be like if people in Little Rock said, if it became the case that people who were disconnected from Christ or disconnected from the church, if it became the case that someone said, you know, that person is a disciple, and if he says it happened, it did. What would that be like? What would it be like if because you were known as a follower of Jesus, if because of that, you could just say, yeah, it happened that way, or yes, I'll do that, or yes, no, I don't recall that. And everybody said, well, it's true. What would that be like? Imagine that. Okay, so we've looked at the kind of the false teaching that the Pharisees gave there. We looked at now the true teaching that Jesus gives. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. For disciples, there's no levels of truth. There's no levels of truth. Now, the hard part about this is, and now we go to our last point, how do we live in light of this? How do we live in light of this? You know, I was kind of pitching some, you know, and knocking little softballs there earlier with some of those, but then I got to the one, how do I look? And, you know, I mean, people's faces look pained. They were, oh, you know, that would hurt them. And part of what's behind that is the idea is like, well, how do I tell the truth and not hurt the person? Do I tell the truth? If I know it's going to hurt the person. So, our last point here, how do we live in light of Jesus' teaching? And I want to give two approaches here. The first thing we want to look at is why it's difficult to do it. Why is it difficult at all? And the next piece is how the gospel helps us to live in light of Jesus' teaching. How we have to connect the gospel to what Jesus is teaching here. Okay, so first, why is it difficult at all? What I want to do is take you down a funnel here. One reason it's difficult for some of us is because of our need of approval. And we don't tell the truth because we're afraid that if we do tell the truth, the person's not going to like us. It's going to cause friction in the relationship. And we don't need that. We need the person's approval. We need the person to like us so we don't tell the truth. You know, we don't say, I don't want to come to that party. We say, I'm sorry, I missed the text. because we want to maintain that relationship in just the way that it exists now. And the invitation to the party we didn't want to go to impinged on our perception of that relationship and the way it ought to be. And we need that relationship to stay in just the way that it is. We need that kind of approval so we don't tell the truth. We shade it. We don't let our yes be a yes or no be no. That's one reason, approval, a need for approval. Another reason is a need for control. And so we don't say what we really think about something because we think that if we do that, we're going to be disclosing a certain information, and that's going to put the other person on an even playing field as us. We don't want to do that. We want to maintain the control. We want to maintain the power in the relationship or in that exchange. And some of us, the needle is all the way toward one of those sides, you know, and some of us, it kind of fluctuates. For some of us, it's not about control. We will give up control to get approval. And for some of us, it's not about the approval. We don't care if people like us unless we're in charge. If we're in charge, I don't care if you like me. That's the control. So some people's needles are all the way on the other side. But sometimes, depending on the relationship or the time in your life, you can kind of go back and forth. What's going on there? Why is it? Why is that the case? What's underneath those two things? And here's what's underneath it. In both of those instances where we don't let our yes be yes, we don't let our no be no, because of either a need for approval or a need for control, what's going on there is we're using that person for our own ends. We are treating people as means to an end. They've become instruments in our grand design for our life. We're using them to get the approval, or we're using them to maintain or gain the control. And even what's under that, and this is the bottom part of the funnel, even what's under that is that we're not willing to pay the price. We're not willing to pay the price of losing some of that person's approval by telling the truth. Not in a heavy-handed way, not in an angry way, with an angry tone and a wagging finger. We don't need that. But telling the truth in a gracious and winsome way, even in that case sometimes, the other person may not respond well to that. Or we're not willing to pay the price to give up some control. We want to keep the information and put the other person at an information disadvantage. And so we can keep it. And we don't want to pay the price. And this is one of the interesting things about this text here in Matthew chapter 5, when Jesus summarizes the teaching from the scribes and the Pharisees in verse 33. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely. Jesus is affirming that. Don't swear falsely. But you shall, the ESV says, perform. You shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. That word perform is translated, and there's about 40 other times that occurs in the New Testament. Almost every other time the ESV translates that, they translate it pay. You shall pay, or you shall repay to the Lord what you have sworn. And remember what I said, part of the problem here is that we don't want to pay the cost. And even here, this idea is that when we're going to be truthful, when our yes is going to be a yes and our no is going to be a no, sometimes that's going to cost us something. How are we going to do that? How are we going to have the power to be able to have that price exacted from us? And the answer I want to submit is having experienced the gospel and having learned how to apply the gospel to the specific issue in our lives. Do you know how to do that? And so in John 18, when Jesus is before one of his trials, one of the guards, Jesus is shackled, one of the guards hits Jesus. And Jesus turns to him and looks at him and says, you hit me because I told you the truth. Jesus had all the approval, you know, as the second person of the Trinity. I referenced that Isaiah passage earlier, where all the angels and archangels, all the stuff bowing down, holy, holy is the Lord. He has all this approval, and he has all the control and all the power, you know? And he gives up all the approval. He gave it up to come down and be disapproved of by people, some of whom ought to have known better, And he gave up the control. There's this chilling scene in the Passion narrative where Jesus has just been beaten severely, and he's standing shackled next to Pilate. And Pilate looks at him like, come on, man. Just say I'm not guilty. Just say it, and I'll let you go. And what he says to Jesus is, I have power to let you go. And Jesus, who's beaten, says, you have no power over me. I could command, you know, a legion of angels to rescue me. And so Jesus, who has all the control and all the power, didn't exercise it. He gave it up to be, quote, controlled by other people. And so one of the reasons it's hard for us to tell the truth is because we're trying to get the approval. And another reason it's hard for us to tell the truth is because we're trying to have control. And how do you be able to pay the price in those things? The way you do it is you see Jesus paying the price for you. You see Jesus giving up the approval that we're seeking and that we can even try to use God to get. You see Jesus giving up the control and the power so that you can be freed from having to have the control and the power. And that's the key about how we apply the gospel to melt our hearts into obedience to what Jesus is speaking about here, as opposed to just saying, well, I better tighten up the belt, better put the suspenders on, and really, we're going to have to work hard at this. We're going to have to work very hard. That's not the gospel. That's moralism. So what you do is you sit with the gospel. You see Jesus giving up approval. Some of you are now locked in these cycles where you have to have a particular person's approval, where you have to have approval on a particular project, and you're locked into it, and it's hard for you to see your way out. Some of you are like the same thing in these kind of control cycles, and it's hard for you to see your way out. And the way you see your way, you got to stop looking at the cycle. You have to stop looking at yourself and what may happen if you pay the price. You have to look to the cross. It's the way out of the cycle. And so when you look to the cross and you see Jesus paying the price for you, it enables you to say, you know, maybe Jesus died so that I could be free from having to have this approval, so that I could be free from having to have the control. And that's how you use the gospel to melt your heart to be a more truthful person, to be able to let your yes be a yes, or your no be no. Because no longer are you getting a sense of personal worth or value or satisfaction from the relationship, so now you can tell the truth. And the same thing about control and power. When you see Jesus giving up approval and control for you, you can begin to give that up in gratitude to him. May that be so in all of our lives. Amen.